Welcome to Crawl Space. I'm Tim, here today with Lance. Lance, how are you today?
I am doing fantastic. It was a wonderful weekend. I hope everyone out there is doing great. How are you, Tim?
I am doing well. Thanks a lot for asking.
You're welcome.
We speak with a new friend in this episode, Lance, a fellow podcaster, someone who has a job that's completely outside the investigation field. It's quite interesting. His name is Ken Davies, and his podcast is called The Mysterious Case of Fred the Head.
You all need to check out this podcast. It's up to 29 episodes. And Fred the Head is an individual, a man whose remains were found in this shallow-type grave in England in 1971. So we've just passed the 50th anniversary of this discovery. And Ken has really picked up the gauntlet on this one to try to figure out the mystery of Fred the Head.
Yeah, it's a fascinating case and a really compelling podcast. I'm almost kind of just completely amazed that he has put together this amount of content really in a consumable way. The show is great and informative, and I really think he's getting somewhere with this mystery. I really think our audience would appreciate this podcast as well.
Yes, very well said, Tim. I think the listeners are going to dig this one a lot. So we are actually coming up on the 51st anniversary of the discovery on March 27th.
Okay, so make sure to check out the show notes and listen to Fred the Head. Lance, we've got some exciting announcements.
We've got two pretty exciting announcements that we can talk about right now that we've talked about in the past. One of them is our new subscription service, and the other one is CrimeCon. Which one do you want to tackle first?
Well, I guess let's get into the subscription service, Lance. It's a new show that we're doing, and we're really trying to bring a lot of bonus content to our audience. First of all, it's ad-free episodes. I know we'll occasionally get the negative review about, oh, it's too many ads, or, well, we've got a perfect solution for you. It's this subscription service. You can get all the episodes ad-free. And you can also get bonus content. Our old Patreon show is up there, as well as our new Crawlspace Crypt that we're still working through the title of, but I think we might be settling on that. But it's kind of a behind-the-scenes look at what we do here at Crawlspace Media and the shows we produce and really how we work and interact.
And depending on which tier you elect to be a part of, you can get those bonus episodes, the ad-free episodes, and then we'll do things like Ask Me Anythings, and we can have listeners join in. So there'll be a lot of bonuses, and we are moving all of our content, like you said, from Patreon to Supporting Cast, the new subscription service. And I've said it before, ad nauseum, it is not because Patreon has done anything wrong. Supporting Cast just has more of the resources that we need, and we were introduced to this platform by our new partners over at Glassbox. Amazing individuals, great company. They help to refine your brand and sell ads, so we can't thank them enough for all that they've done. They will also be at CrimeCon, so I think that was a pretty good segue. That's what they call a pro segue.
Wow, you are a pro. And we're going to CrimeCon at the end of April, and it's going to be an absolute blast. We're going to try to do two live shows there, one Crawl Space, one Missing. We have submitted these to the good people at CrimeCon, and we're waiting for official confirmation. So once we have our time slots, we'll let you know when and where that's going to happen. And you can use code CrawlSpace at CrimeCon.com when you check out for your standard badge. You'll get 10% off, Lance.
Who doesn't want to go to Vegas on April 29th? Who doesn't want to hang out on Podcast Row with us?
No one.
No one. Code CrawlSpace, 10% off.
Can't wait to see everybody there. So thanks a lot for listening, everybody. Make sure to check out The Mysterious Case of Fred the Head, and we're going to cut to commercial right here, but we'll be right back with Ken Davies. Thanks a lot for listening.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of The Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, Listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Welcome to the podcast, Ken Davis. How are you today?
I'm very good indeed. Thank you for inviting me on the Crawl Space podcast.
Well, you are more than welcome on these airwaves anytime you want to come on. You're covering this case, this extraordinary mystery that is going on 50 years, right? It's been going on like almost half a century, and I do want to get into it. But I can't help but notice the jersey behind you. Anyone who's not watching this, he's got a jersey with the number 9, and it looks like Cincinnati Bengals colors.
It is Cincinnati Bengals. I'm a huge Cincinnati Bengals fan. I spent a bit of time a few years ago in Cincinnati, work-wise, and just fell in love with the city, to be honest. And great people. And the Midwest of America is my favorite part of America. And I needed an NFL team to follow. And after that, it was always going to be the Bengals. And I've gone through years and years of disappointment and desolation. But not this year. Not this year. So sorry about that. So I'm very excited about Sunday, the Super Bowl. And I've got my fingers crossed so much. I've got everything crossed.
Me too. I definitely very excited for the game. I think we'll probably be releasing this after the big game. But for your sake, I hope Cincinnati wins. And that would be, I just hope for a good game. I just want to see a fun, close, competitive game.
I don't. I want to see 45-0.
You want a low stress game.
I'm not interested in an exciting game at all.
So I know that Cincinnati historically has not been that great. So considering that, if they lose on Sunday, are you still claiming the season as a victory? Like, do they have to win?
No. It's been a fabulous, joyful, joyous ride. It really has. And how they have created that kind of team ethos, that kind of team spirit from the depths of despair. It's been a miracle, and I'm so proud of them. Whatever they do, they could get beat 100-0 on Sunday, and I could not be prouder of them.
All right. Well, we're excited about your podcast called Fred the Head, and it is a deep dive, an extreme deep dive, even if you will. Can you tell us a little bit about your background? Who are you, and why did you take this podcast on?
Well, it's entirely fateful. So I don't have any kind of background in investigative journalism or certainly broadcast media. Never done anything like that before. But I run a media business, but we're more in events and websites than we are in broadcast media. But I've done a lot of interviewing over the years. I'm not in the first flush of youth. You know, I've been on the planet for a few years. And in those years, I've done a lot of interviewing with lots of different people. So I kind of knew the technology, but I certainly didn't go into this expecting to end up producing a podcast. And how I got into that was extremely fateful. So we'd moved house. We'd sold a house where we were living and moved to this little picturesque village in the middle of England. And it is the quintessential English village as well. Lots of Americans would have in their mind what a country village in the UK would look like. Well, this was it, a place called Newton Solney. And I've kind of always been interested in history anyway. And that kind of place has a deep history. I mean, and deep for England, which means thousands of years. So people have been living around there for over 1,000 years. So Anglo-Saxons and Vikings and things like that. And I was interested in that. And I was happened to be just looking at the kind of history of the village as we moved in the weeks after we'd moved in. And I came across in that process, completely accidentally, a story about someone being found, a dead body being found, literally 300 yards away from my house. And I thought, well, that's interesting. And this was back in 1971. So it was in the recent past. I thought, that's interesting. And let's look into this and see what happened, who he was, who killed him, how it all turned out. And I quickly came to realize there was no turnout. Nothing happened. No one was identified as being that body. No one was identified as being the perpetrator. It simply hit a brick wall about a year after this body was found with no revelations whatsoever. So I'm intrigued by that point. So, well, what really? In England, that doesn't happen. I mean, I should put that in context. There's probably 13 undetected John Does in the UK in the whole of the last century. So this is, I mean, the States is different. In England, everybody gets found because, you know, it just doesn't happen very often. So this was really, really unusual. But anyway, I left it there like any normal human being would leave it there, move on and think about other things. And I was back in the office in my in the office I used to run in a place called Derby, which is about 5 miles away. And I happened to be having a conversation with someone who worked in a different company in that office. And I was saying, hey, I've just read this really weird story and I don't know what it's all about, but, you know, someone got found 300 yards from my house, never been solved. It was found by a man called David Nathan. And I mentioned this to this guy. I said, it was found by this guy called David Nathan. And he said, I know him. I said, no, you won't know him. This is from 50 years ago, this fella found him. He said, no, I know him. And I could put you in contact with him if you wanted me to. And so I ended up, very fatefully, ending up with the telephone number of the man who found him. Now, again, I don't know what came over me, but I wouldn't normally ring the man who'd found a body 50 years ago. But one Friday afternoon in the office, it was Friday afternoon in the office time, you know, kind of run out of things to do by 3 o'clock. And I thought, I'm going to ring David Nathan. And I'd spoken to a few people about, should I? And they just do it, get out of your system. Just talk to him and whatever happens, happens. But I decided to record it on my phone. So I called him on my work phone, recorded it on my mobile. And because I just thought, I want to keep a record of what he says. Not because I wanted to develop a podcast at that point. I just wanted to keep a verbatim record of what was said. So I rang him. Took a couple of calls because he was pretty nervous about a stranger talking about this. But I kind of developed a bit of a rapport with him. Arranged to call him back. Did call him back. And then had a long conversation with him about how he found the body. And there were some very odd things about that. And so at the end of that conversation, I was teetering on the edge of getting involved in this because certain things had been revealed in that conversation that I thought, I want to find out more about this. Nobody has found this person's identity. Nobody's found who's killed him. If we don't do it now, we never will. We never ever will. So I kind of chatted to a few people and said, should I get involved or should I not? And everybody said, no, go on, get involved. No one else is going to do it. So that's how it started. And that was back in March 2019, so 3 years ago. And then we just started to add discovery onto that. And that's really where it came from.
That is incredible. I love the fact that you didn't even intend to do this and you're apprehensive, but there was just something driving you to get, you know, an answer for this and an answer for that. And I can't imagine like the amount of anxiety that was probably going through you when you were calling Mr. Nathan. So how old was he when he discovered the body and how old was he when you spoke with him?
Well, he was about 23 when 24 maybe when he discovered the body, and he's now in his mid 70s, obviously. So the body was found in March 1971, 26th of March, Friday. And I mean, I can go into the detail if you wish in terms of how it was found and the circumstances it was found and the circumstances it was in when it was found.
Yeah, I would love to hear all those details.
So David Nathan worked with a man called Garth Hamp Gopsell, and they had a small jewelry and watchmakers company. And he also, they also had a, they were gunsmiths. So they also sold and maintained guns. So what they used to do quite regularly is cross a bridge onto an island in the River Trent. So all this is happening in an island in the middle of a river, bizarrely. And what he used to do, he used to go over the bridge and he used to shoot pigeons. Really what they were doing, he was just testing the guns that they'd been maintaining just to make sure they were operational. But he used to do this very regularly. He used to do it probably a few times a week, really regularly. And that bridge was gated, but he had a key. So he unlocked the gate, went over, went up a little rise where he normally went to, on top of a bank, to see if there was anything he could shoot. So, but there was nothing there. So he started to walk back and noticed on the ground what he thought was an upturned saucer. Looked like a normal saucer upside down. And he hit it with the base, the stock of his gun. So he hit it and it sounded hollow. He thought, that's odd. Had a little closer look and thought, that's not a plate. That looks like the top of a skull. So went back to the workshop, got a shovel and started to excavate around this skull. And sure as eggs are eggs, it was a human skull, quite clearly. Now, it's worth saying at this point, David Nathan is what is called a special constable. So he's involved with the police force, but he's not a policeman. He's kind of an auxiliary policeman. So he knows the police people. But, and this is the first of many, many strange things about this case, he doesn't ring the police at that point. He rings his partner, his business partner, Garth Hamp Gopsell, who just happens to be at the school teaching children about firearms. Now, this is long before mobiles, so he would have had to go back, make a call. Someone would have had to go and find Garth. Then Garth comes all the way back to Newton Solney, where he lives, and they both then go and have a look at the school and dig it out a bit more. And at that point, probably an hour and a half after the first initial discovery, they both decide, we better call the police. Because they'd seen inside the skull and had noticed a denture. Now, there are many skulls that have been found around the area which are 1,000 years old, because people have been there for that length of time. But they didn't have dentures. This is something which was clearly modern. And therefore, they said, we've got to do something about this. So they rang the police, and the police descended on the scene. But by that time, it was late. It was about 7:30, which in March is dark over here. And so they couldn't do anything that day. So they erected a screen around it and then came back on the Saturday and started to properly excavate the body. So that's how the body was discovered.
Okay, interesting. So Fred the Head is not just a head.
No, he's a complete body, and always was a complete body until the police decided to decapitate him. He was decapitated by the authorities, not by the perpetrator. So the perpetrator kept the body. It was in one piece. But there were strange things about the burial. If I have never buried a body, and I'm assuming neither of you two have either, but if I ever did, okay.
Just kidding. I'm kidding.
If I was to bury a body, I'd dig a channel, a kind of a body-shaped hole, and roll him in and fill it in. That would be my go-to process. But Fred wasn't buried like that. Fred was buried kneeling down in an upright position, which is strange. So he was buried in the side of the bank that David Nathan had walked up, next to an ancient kiln. So on that piece of land in the island, 100 years ago, there'd been a lime manufacturing process was happening there. It was what we called a flint mill. And there'd been some kilns where things used to be heated up and things. Now in the bank next to that, one of those kilns was where the body was deposited, but he was deposited upright. That's why the top of his skull had become exposed. So he's literally kneeling in an upright position.
So that hole was dug specifically for him?
Yes.
What is did you say a flint mill? Is that where they produce flints from, like a lighter or something?
No, it was really a process by which flint was heated in order to extract minerals from it.
I see.
It's from an ancient process going back hundreds and hundreds of years. So it was an industrial process, but there were ruins of that factory, if you like, there from 100 years ago. And it's in the ruins of that where this hole was dug and Fred was deposited. Now, it's also probably worth saying that site is extremely unknown to even people who live in the area of Newton Solney and Winds Hill, where this village was, and Burton, which is the big, larger town next to it. No one knows that site. Extremely difficult to get to. So whoever did put him there definitely knew it. And that is one of the clues in it, of course. You would not find it.
Right. So it's kind of an old or maybe ancient area, but the body wasn't ancient?
The body was definitely not ancient for a number of reasons. Firstly, he had a denture. So obviously they went really in that form available until the 30s and 40s in the UK. But also he had a ring. There was a ring on his right hand wedding ring finger. Now, everybody in the UK, if they get married, wears a wedding ring on their left wedding ring finger. This was on the right wedding ring finger. And that was a plain gold band. But it was a woman's wedding ring. This was a man with the hands of a woman. Now, if I took my wedding ring off and put it on, or if my wife took her wedding ring off and put it on my finger, it would not fit on my wedding ring finger. It just wouldn't fit. And that is the case in the vast majority of people. But in this instance, the wedding ring on his right wedding ring finger was a woman's size. So therefore, he would have been in the bottom 5% population of male hand sizes.
Sorry to interrupt. It was a woman's size or a woman's style ring?
A woman's size. It was as plain a band of gold as you can find. So men wear very plain bands of gold. So do women. This was one of those. But it would have been sold as a woman's ring because of the size.
I see.
Now, the other aspect of that, of course, it was hallmarked. All gold in the UK has a hallmark. And those hallmarks identify certain things about that ring. They identify who made it, and they identify when it was made. And they are entirely trustworthy. So we could tell, or the police could tell back then, that by looking at the hallmark, that ring had been made either in late 1967 or early 1968. Could not have been made at any other time. So that means the window of deposition becomes very narrow, because it was found in 71, but had a ring that couldn't have been bought, because it wouldn't have been made, before the middle of 1967.
Amazing. I happen to know that because my father was left-handed, he wore his wedding band on his right hand because that was not his dominant hand, and it was less of a chance that that would get damaged at work. So if he was working with his left hand more, he didn't want to lose or damage the wedding ring, so he wore it on his right hand. Is that where the line of thinking is for Fred the Head?
No, it's not, but that's a very good, that's an interesting point. Actually, there are three potential explanations that I've heard in terms of wearing wedding rings on the right wedding ring finger. Firstly, and we'll come back to this in other evidence, many Eastern European nations wear their wedding rings on their right wedding ring finger. It's connected to you. They feel it's a more direct route to the heart. So, for example, Hungarians, Czechoslovakians, Polish people, Germanic people wear it on, Danish people wear it on the right hand, their right hand rather than their left hand. So that's one explanation, and we'll come back to that. There's another explanation. People who now would be live in the gay community often wear rings on their right hand rather than their left hand. That was a thing back then as well. So it could imply that whoever is buried there was living that lifestyle. So that definitely could be it as well. The other thing, of course, is that it might not have been a wedding ring, or he may not have worn it as a wedding ring at all. It was simply a decoration, and he wore it on that hand because he wasn't married. He was simply one that happened to fit him, and he happened to like it. So it could be nothing to do with marriage. I think that's unlikely. I think the other two are more likely. But you're right. Another explanation that's not occurred to me before this conversation is that it could have been because actually it was more convenient from a working perspective to wear it on his right hand.
Well, case closed. You're welcome.
Well, I was confused. I was surprised to hear that the medical examiner didn't actually rule a cause of death. Is that accurate?
Yeah. It's probably worth me giving you a bit more information in terms of how they found the body, because that will explain
please.
That a bit more. So the body was, he was a man. He was around 28, give or take 5 years either side. He clearly had very extensive dentistry. I mean, very extensive. He had a denture. He had lots of fillings. He was 28. You know, that's a lot of work for someone who's 28. He also was completely naked, apart from a pair of socks and the ring. And he'd been tied. And he'd been tied in a particular way. So he'd been tied around the wrists. He'd been tied around the ankles. And then those two pieces of twine had been tied together with a third piece of twine. So there was, so clearly, something illegal had happened, because there was some suggestion, and particularly actually by the medical examiners when he was found, when that autopsy was done, that it was some kind of sexual practice that had gone wrong, something maybe to do with auto-asphyxiation. Because the other thing to mention is there's no cause of death. There's no obvious cause of death. That doesn't mean he wasn't killed. It just means he wasn't shot, or didn't appear to be stabbed, didn't appear to have been strangled. So there's no obvious cause of death, but there were these bindings. So one of the views, in fact, the view that was taken by the authorities, was this could have been an unfortunate accident to do with sexual practices. Now, and therefore, when that process was completed, it was what we call an open verdict. So there was no, really, they had no idea what had happened here. Now, the police took a completely different view at the time. They were sure it was a murder. They were sure it was a murder because he didn't bury himself, and he probably didn't take his own clothes away because his clothes were gone and never to be seen again. So although the authorities, when I say the authorities, what I'm talking about here is the legal authorities, class this as an open verdict, an open case, the police immediately investigated it as if it was a homicide.
So the wedding or the gold band was dated around 1967 or 68. Is that correct?
Yeah. The strange thing about hallmarks is that some are for specific years and that year alone, and some cross years. And mm-hmm. that was a hallmark that crossed from July 1967 to July 1968.
So assuming that that ring did belong to him and wasn't placed there on his finger by somebody else, and assuming that he was murdered right around the time that he got the ring, he would have, the longest he could have been in the ground was 3 years, right?
Well, yes, but when they did obviously the tests in terms of how the body had decomposed in that time. Now, bear in mind, this is 1950. The standards today and the standards in 1950, I suspect, are radically different in terms of the accuracy of that. But they said he'd been in the ground between 9 and 18 months. So that essentially would, because he was found at the end of March 1971, that really takes it between, let's say, spring 1969 to summer 1970. That would also, of course, fit in with the age of the ring. So it's probably, I've always worked on this basis that he died in 69 or 70.
Was there any account of any individual missing during that time that is on record at all? Any newspaper article or anything like that?
Okay. Yes and no. We've discovered things, but they didn't. So it's probably, we've discovered lots of things that the police never got near on this. So the police investigation was poor, really not good. So let me explain. They decided, the police decided that clearly the route to identify this person was through the dental work. It was so unusual and so extensive, it must be possible to identify this person through the dentistry records of dentists in the UK. Obvious. I mean, that's how people are identified from plane crashes. So they're certainly going to be identifiable from this body in this tiny village in the middle of England, miles away from any big town. It's going to be easy. So that's what they did. And that's it. They threw everything at that, and they never found him. So although everything should point to an easy, and in fact in the newspapers at the time when they were reporting what they were doing, they were expecting to solve this next Thursday. They were expecting someone would say, yeah, I recognize that person, or someone was going to come forward and say, my friend Frank is missing, and they're going to solve it easily. But it never happened. And the fact that they couldn't trace the dentistry anywhere in the UK, one is a huge clue for us, but was an absolute disaster for the police, because they took 18 months to do it, by which time anyone who might have been involved in this was long gone.
And we'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsors.
Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com. Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com. Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com. Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com.
Thanks to our sponsors, and now we're back to the program.
Yeah, just a quick question about how they searched for who would have performed that dental work. You said that it was extensive and unusual, so it would have stood out in any dentist's recollection that someone would go through, especially back then, right? Because it must have taken maybe years to achieve that type of dental work when you're talking about like healing and, you know, paying for it. Like, how did they not find anybody?
Because he probably wasn't here. That's what they never thought that. That's what, of course, most people would now deduce. There was very unusual aspects about this dentistry. The way the dentistry had been performed, he'd had two teeth extracted and replacements put in on the same day. That just doesn't happen in the UK. There was extensive other types of dentistry. So what they did was they literally interviewed as all the dentists within 150 miles, didn't find anyone, then exhibited his dentistry at the UK's main dental exhibition in 1971, which literally the whole dental industry went to. They published all his dentistry in all of the dental publications around the UK. Absolutely nothing came back. But all this took years. It literally took 18 months to do. So they found, because they were convinced that was the route to solving it, and because it wasn't, they kind of let some of the other things not happen. So for example, it's an important point to mention that this deposition site was right next to a really big mill. So they made bread and essentially wheat. It was a wheat grinding mill, really old fashioned one, where they used the river to power the water wheel. Very old fashioned mill called Greensmith's Mill. Now Greensmith's Mill was across what we call a weir from the deposition site. Now a weir is like a small dam that controls the level of water. I don't know what you'd phrase it as in the US, but it's literally a built embankment in the river to control the water supply into the mill. And occasionally, people who worked at the mill would have to go across the bridge where the body was to get to the other side of that weir to clear any debris off that weir. Because if the debris stayed on the weir, it would destroy the weir. So it needed to be taken away. So the mill, with all its people working there, with access to the deposition site, because you could also walk across the weir if the river was very low, no one at the mill was ever interviewed. I know now five or six people at that mill, none of them were interviewed. In fact, very few people were ever interviewed in the vicinity about the death.
Well, that's frustrating because I think it sounds like the area could hold some real clues. Obviously, in addition to the dental work, I think his socks that he was wearing, I think that's something I want to ask you about as well. But it does seem like It's a small area, and not many people would have even been aware of that that exact spot.
I would imagine less than 100 people knew that spot at the time.
I mean, that's a huge clue. So that it's almost shocking that this hasn't been solved.
It's shocking, but it's a God's gift to a podcast, isn't it? I mean, if I literally, I should go to church on Sunday and thank him for delivering me, Fred the Head, 300 yards away from where I was living.
Well, because not this Sunday, because you'll be watching Cincinnati.
That's right.
That's not till 11 o'clock at night in the UK, so I've got
Oh, you have plenty of time.
Plenty of time for both.
While you're there, yeah, have him or her put in a good word, good energy.
I'm there all day until half past 10 on Sunday night. So, but you're right. This is the weird thing about it, because that particular deposition site has only four methods of getting to it. And these are those four. One, over the bridge. The bridge was locked, had a locked gate, but you could get over the bridge because that's what David Nathan did to find it. So you could go that way. The second way was going round through, there's a small track off a bridge over the River Trent that would eventually take you to that place. It's a place called Bass's Meadow. And not many people knew it, but you could get there that way. So that's a possibility. Someone could have gone across Bass's Meadow to take him there. The third way is over the weir, this small dam. When that gets very, very low, and the River Trent gets very low and it gets very high, it floods as well. But when it's low, it's possible to walk across the weir from the mill. So that's the third way. The fourth way is by boat. Now, someone could have come by boat. You couldn't get past the weir, but you wouldn't have had to get past the weir to deposit the body there. Now, taking a body by boat is an extreme way of doing it. And I don't think for a moment that's what happened, but that is the fourth way. But the point is, that space where he was buried was so unknown to people and so inaccessible to people that in and of itself, it's a huge clue that he was buried there. I've spoken to a lot of senior investigators and homicide detectives in the UK since starting this. Every single one of them has said, people do not bury bodies in places they do not know, because they need to know the entry, they need to know the exit routes, they need to know they won't be disturbed, they need to know what they're going to need to bury the body. They may have prepared the hole before. So it's absolutely certain, in my opinion, that whoever killed him or was involved with his burial knew that site.
Yeah, it does sound like that. And I do want to ask again about David Nathan. And I know he said he was sort of looked at as a suspect or something originally. What was that experience like for him?
I think it was a tough one. I've got to know David quite well. I mean, I speak to David probably once a month or so, just in the course of the more investigations. And, you know, more things have come to light on that. But, you know, I do still believe, and I haven't really ever changed my view on this, is that he was the unfortunate person who found him. Lots of people, certainly in the early days, I think, suggested more than that. I don't. I have no reason to think that he's anything but the person who, unfortunately, in this mystery, has a very central role through no making of his own. He found it by accident in the sense of that was his playground. I mean, he was there three times a week. I mean, he had a reason to go, but he never, ever saw anyone there. No one ever, ever saw anyone there. I mean, when I've been there myself now, you can't really get to the actual site now, very close to it, you'll never see anyone there. So it is, and everybody who I've spoken to who lives in the vicinity, and of course I've spoke to lots of them now, all say the same thing. Whoever buried that body knew that space.
And you mentioned that you spoke to a lot of members of law enforcement, investigators, and they gave you some information on, you know, burying a body and some insight on that. How often do you speak with law enforcement about this case? How are you received? And is there anybody actively working on it?
It's a tricky one. It's considered an open case. So therefore, I have to be honest, and I don't blame them in the slightest for this. I'm in regular contact with the with Staffordshire Police about this, who are handling this. If anything I come up with, I think they need to know about this, I let them know about that. But there isn't a lot coming back the other way. And it's an open case, so why should there be? Most of the law enforcement people I've spoken to are people who either have, for example, I tracked down the man who dug him out, the scenes of crimes officer, who now lives in Australia. I found him and we talked about how he dug him out and what he saw, because he was the first person to see him since he died. So when I've spoken to retired law enforcement people, they are the people who have said to me, look, this is... In fact, the scenes of crimes officer said this was absolutely a murder. And everybody I've spoken to on that side is convinced that the circumstances are so unusual it's clearly a murder. So they consider it a live case. Hand on heart, do I think they're putting as much work into it as me? No. And why should they, really? There are other cases, recent cases, today's cases, that they really do have a moral duty to be solving. I don't think anyone would thank them for spending a lot of time on a 50-year-old murder they haven't successfully investigated today and leaving today's cases unresolved. So I'm not critical of them. In fact, I'm kind of glad they're not, because it gives me the free space to do my thing.
Without giving anything away, I want to talk a little bit about episode 23, The Man from the North. Can you give as much info as you feel comfortable? Again, like, people should be listening to this and to your podcast to get the full story, but it's so fascinating.
From 1 to 23, we covered a lot of ground. And I have to say, a lot of stuff that's now being revealed in episode 29 and 30 goes back to the earlier episodes. So there's a lot of circularity about this. But something big happened in 23, in episode 23, where I get contacted completely randomly. Now, it's worth saying, when I started this podcast, one of the purposes was to raise awareness of the case, raise awareness outside the UK of the case, because it increasingly became apparent that this person wasn't local. So I certainly wanted to make sure that as many people knew about this as possible. And over a period of time, of course, the listenership has grown and grown and grown and grown. And randomly, about 3 months ago now, 2.5 months ago, guy calls me and says, "We've got to talk, Ken. We've got to talk about Fred the Head." Now, quite a few people have said that to me in the past, and I'm kind of, I'm very happy to talk about it, but is there a particular reason for you wanting to talk to me about it? And he said, "Yes, because I know who did it. I know why he did it. I know who he is. I know how they killed him. I know why they buried him there. I know the full story." So I'm kind of saying, go on, kind of thing. And he's got my interest at this point, clearly. I say, "Well, why are you telling me this? Why are you telling this to the police? They're probably the first call you need to make." And he says, "Well, I've tried that. I've been interviewed by the police. I was a year ago, they interviewed me, and I've not heard a word. I've not heard anything since. And I need to get this off my chest. I know what happened. I need to tell you now." So that's a big revelation. It's the kind of thing you dream of happening. Ultimately, you want someone who reveals it, because someone does know, and you want that person to reveal it. But he wasn't making a confession on his own part. This person was the nephew of the person he said killed Fred or was involved in his death. So he gave me the complete story. And that story is so huge in terms of its scale and its ramifications. I haven't really revealed the whole story on the podcast even yet. I've revealed 75% of it. But I have to be careful, because just because somebody confesses on behalf of someone else doesn't make it true. So my job then in this aspect of the case was to try to piece together whether I could verify what I'd been told. So episode 23 is me telling the story I was told, 70% of it. It gives the full picture in relation to Fred as to how he died, why he was there, who killed him, how he was killed. But then episode 24 and onwards has been me trying to work out whether that's true or not. It could be the work of a fantasist. I know the person who's told me that quite well now. I happen to like him. I don't know. And what I'm going through at the moment is a process of trying to verify whether what he's claiming can possibly be true. And that's a process that is taking a long time and will continue to take a long time. But it's an important thing to say, there's a number of threads in this. So that just becomes one of the possible explanations. But there are probably four other possible explanations for who Fred is. And that becomes one of those strands in the rope that I've got to pull and pull and pull until I can break it. And one of them won't break, and that will be the explanation. But that's just one of them. But it's an incredibly intriguing one.
And did you take any of this information to law enforcement?
He's already done that for me. So he's been to law enforcement. He's sat down with law enforcement for 3 hours and said, this is what happened. He did that a year ago. And they've just ignored it, as far as I can see.
And you believe him, or you consider it to a degree?
I'd say I'm about 45% convinced. I have a process that I go through. I mean, I come from a science background. I'm a chemist. So I'm kind of go through it in as scientific way as I possibly can. So if I'm trying to prove something, I do it experimentally. Essentially, he's making a claim. Well, I'm going to test that claim. So if that claim is, let's give you a simple one. I am the nephew of a man called this. We call him Mr. A. Well, that's a claim. And it's a claim that has to be true for everything else to be true in this story. So therefore, one aspect of the process I go through is to identify whether he really was the nephew of that man and whether that man did really exist. And I can do that through births, marriages, and death certifications in the UK. I can do it through Ancestry. I can do it through Find My Past, all those kind of things, genealogy sites. I can find out whether that person really existed. And so there are probably, in the story that he's told me, 12 of those points where I can go through that and verify it experimentally. And we're working our way through those 12. And I'm probably about 5 through that. And I would say so far, even though it's an incredibly far-fetched story, it's got over the hurdles so far. But that doesn't mean it's true. It means it's 40% through the process of being proven it's true. If even one of these 12 is false, the whole thing's false. So I have to wait and go through it in a systematic way.
Interesting. What about the John Doe, I guess, Fred? Is it thought of that he's from a different area?
Spoiler alert, but I'll give some tasters. you know, because there's nothing to talk about if I don't talk about what we've done in the episode, these 28 episodes. One of the things that we did, I started to look around for any work that had been done on this skull. Now, bear in mind, at this point, thanks to law enforcement, we have a skull and we have a body. That body's already been buried, and it's buried with four other people in this cemetery in near Burton. But the skull has not yet been buried, and this is back in 2015, long before I got involved with it. But police, given up on it, really. We need to bury the skull with the rest of the body. We can't keep this skull on our shelves forever. It needs to go with the rest of the body. So they get in contact with the University of Derby, which I find out absolutely accidentally, and ask the University of Derby, which is the local university, to do a 3D image of the skull. So they do. And then they reinter the skull. But not only did they do a 3D image of the skull, they put this skull through a software program called Cranid. Now, Cranid is a software system, a database, which has got the measurements of tens of thousands of skulls around the world. Really, because to see if there's any kind of correlation between geographical area and skull types, effectively. And they put this skull through that system. I don't even know if the police still know this, but they did. And I spoke to the guy who did that piece of work. And bear in mind, if this person died in 1969 or 1970 in England, everyone was pretty much English. There were some people who were in the UK who had originally come from India. There were some who had come from the West Indies. But 90%, and certainly where we're talking in this little village in Burton-upon-Trent, 95% of people were from the UK. You would expect that skull to come up in that database, definitely English. Has to be. But it didn't. It came up as Eastern European, Hungarian, Danish. Now, these things are not definitive. So it's very important. It's, that kind of software is part of the toolbox of people looking at these things, but in and of itself, it's not definitive. So they couldn't say he's definitely Hungarian, but the probabilistic view was this person probably Hungarian or Danish, and then English. So I'm thinking, well, this is huge. He's not English. This is why they couldn't find his dentistry. This is why they couldn't find anything to do with him. This is why no one reported him, because he wasn't from the UK. So I then realize I need to be looking for Hungarians. That's a start point. Hungarians. We may move on to that later. And in fact, in the work I'm doing literally today, we're moving on from that. But I start looking at Hungarians, and I find that someone working at the mill was Hungarian. That of itself is weird. So I start looking into the man, the Hungarian working at the mill, a man called Frank Kuhn. Frank Kuhn was married to a lady called Waltraud Kuhn, German lady, and they had a daughter called Zoe. Now, Frank, Waltraud, and Zoe emigrate to Australia about 6 months after the midpoint of when this body's killed. So very soon after this body would have been killed, Frank, the Hungarian, and his wife and his daughter clear off as far away from Burton as pretty much you can get to. Now, this starts to be, for me, a smoking gun. Whether it's a smoking gun in the end, we'll find out. But what am I going to do? Because he's in Australia and he's dead, as I work out. So I find Frank's daughter, Zoe, in Australia, and she lives in the outback, middle of nowhere in Australia. So one day, because I've, by this stage, I don't mind ringing anyone up because I've got so used to it. It was way outside my comfort zone before, way outside. But now I'm ringing total strangers and asking them very impertinent questions. So I find Zoe in Australia and ring her one day and say, Zoe, I need to talk to you about the mill. And I established this amazing relationship with Zoe. And Zoe, who was only 10 when she left, has got a photographic memory of Newton Solney and the mill and everything that was going on, the island, the bridge, the people. And her father, Frank, was a was an amazing man in his own right. He was a multilingualist. Everybody used to come to him who wasn't from the UK to get his help. But there were some very suspicious things, because at the time they emigrated to Australia, the Kun family also tried to emigrate to South Africa, to Canada, in fact, anywhere that wasn't Burton. And the only reason they ended up in Australia was their acceptance came through first. So off they went, which is odd. Certainly, you know, I can understand why people emigrated. Lots of people did emigrate, but their process of emigration just seemed strange. It was like, we want to be anywhere, Canada, South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, anywhere but here. So anyway, I get to know Zoe very well. And through those conversations, we've got to be able to piece together a lot in terms of what was happening in and around that area in 1969 and 1970. Don't want to give too much away, but there's lots and lots and lots of things that would come out of that.
That's incredible that she was so receptive to it, and you're working with her on a productive level. I think that's fantastic. And it kind of starts to play out in my head, like, less of you discovering this mystery and more like the mystery discovering you. And because a lot of the things that you've said were just happenstance and accident, and where you're sitting right now, that's actually very close to the location. Is that?
Well, we moved about a year ago, back to Derby. So I'm now 4 miles from it, but I was 400 yards from it.
Yeah, see, something like that to me is like fascinating that, you know, that happened. And you also said something about the University of Derby where by accident you discovered or they ended up doing these recreations. How did that come to be?
Well, that was completely accidental in the sense of me finding out they'd been involved at all, because I rang their head of forensic science, because early in the process, I thought I need a forensic science input into this. I'm doing all the discovery of people. I want to talk to someone about a school. I know, I'll ring the guy, the head of forensic science at the University of Derby, which is a local Derby, so local university. So I pick up the phone, as I now do all the time, and say, you don't know me, but I'm doing this thing on Fred the Head. Have you ever heard of it? And he said, what do you mean, have we ever heard of it? I've got his skull in my cupboard. So, what do you mean? He said, we've got the 3D image of his skull. We were involved in, didn't you know? No.
Of course he does. Yeah.
Yeah. And we really went from there. So I didn't know they'd been involved in any way. I was just being nosy and trying to get help where it wasn't asked for. And they came up trumps. And so that only then did I discover this whole Hungarian Kranid, a software thing. So there's been a million of those, though. I mean, one of the things that astounds me about this, because really what I've done is this has been a diary of an ordinary person, me, trying to solve an extraordinary case. And normally it should have petered away after about 3 episodes. You know, I've told the story. We've spoke to the guy he's found in. I can bring you up to date with where everything is. And what else is there to tell? But it has never been like that. So when we started with a blank sheet of paper, when I start a new podcast, I don't know really what's going to be in the next podcast, because there's so many things happening. And it's happened from the start where people would come forward and say, I know something you need to know. or we discover something in the newspaper from 50 years ago that everyone had forgotten, or we find someone who shouldn't be there, and I'll explain what I mean by that, who was there. So many weird things, so many weird things have just been discovered every 2 weeks, regular as clockwork, and just means that we can keep moving this forward all the time.
That is, I think you said it before, like it's a podcaster's dream to put the episode out there, and then, you know, that stirs up something, some detail that was overlooked or never discovered in the first place, and you get to take your time and like work with it and tell the best story around it. So that's very fortunate. And we're actually probably going to have you make some calls for us. Maybe you can find out what happened to some paintings that were stolen in Boston, you know, and be like, oops, I just found them. You know, they were buried in my barn.
Yeah, I have been very lucky. I know I've been lucky. And in a way, it's the look of the amateur. It is the look of the amateur in the sense of, because I've not been involved with podcasts before, I had no preconceived ideas of what I was doing, really. I had no experience of interviewing people who were not in broadcast media. I didn't really know what to expect. And that was fortunate in a way. The other thing I think was fortunate, and again, this was accidental, was to make a commitment to people. I'm going to tell you every two weeks where we're at with this. Absolutely, religiously. And that forces me, and it's really hard work because I've got a job, so it's hard. But when you've made that commitment and you've got literally tens of thousands of people listening, you can't the next Tuesday or the next Sunday say, sorry, guys, I haven't been able to do anything on it. Just wasn't going to wash. So actually committing to every 2 weeks, you know, you're going to get an update on Fred the Head, and every one of these strands will be edged a little bit further forward. Whilst it puts a lot of pressure on the podcaster, it's a really healthy thing in terms of content generation.
Sounds like you got to quit your job.
I couldn't afford to do that. I mean, you guys might make a fortune doing what you do. I'd be destitute.
Sounds
most
familiar.
Of us, yeah. Most of us are.
I haven't got time to look either, in the sense of it's so, my week is so kind of divided into, right, these next 3 hours, Fred, these next 3 hours, Fred. And it's so focused on content generation that, you know, I don't even think about the marketing of the product, which is terrible, but that's where we are with it.
Well, you know, if your product's really good, after a while, the trick is the consistency to keep going with it. You know, we certainly aren't buying several homes and cars and boats, but, you know, if you keep doing it and you're consistent with it and your content has a degree of quality, then people will find you and, you know, you'll get people wanting to help you because they care about the story that you're telling.
I think that's true. I think it's a community now. And it's not just me. You know, this is an important thing to say. About the same time I launched the podcast, unbeknownst to me, a man called Neil DeVille, who I've got to know quite well in the UK, launched a Facebook page called Who is Fred the Head? So around the same time, I started last year, independently, we were both thinking about this poor man. So he'd launched this Facebook page, and I was already into producing the podcast that hadn't been released. So obviously we kind of touched base and said, look, we should do these two kind of things in tandem. I didn't want to create a Facebook page when there was already a one being produced. So the two things run hand in hand. So, and that Facebook page has got, you know, nearly 1,000 people on it all the time. And their ideas and the ideas of people within that Facebook page are very important in terms of generating ideas, in terms of where we take this. So it is properly a community effort, this. I just happen to be the person with the recording technology and the time to have probably the balls to ring people randomly who don't know me. And so therefore I get on the face of it in that way. But there's a huge amount of positivity on the Facebook page about what we're trying to do, because, you know, it is something that people in this town and people in this place want resolving. You know, they want to give this person a proper burial. They want his real name back. He's not called. If he ends up being actually called Fred Head, I'm going to give up. But he won't. So he needs his real name, whoever he is, and his family need to be told that we never forgot him. And that real story needs to be told, not the one that we, or the story of us trying to solve his murder.
You'll find another missing person story, or you'll find another mystery that you can't fully wrap your head around, and then you'll start another podcast based on that, right?
Yeah, right. In the sense of that's already germinating in my mind now.
Oh, yeah. What do you got?
I'm not going to go there. There's about three options. One of them I'm pretty excited about. My problem is, I really feel like I'm two-timing Fred.
Yeah.
And I don't want a two-time Fred. People have two-timed Fred for 50 years, and that's why he hasn't been solved. So I have a problem with that, in the sense of I feel incredible guilt about two-timing Fred. I know that sounds perverse, but it's absolutely how I feel about it. So, you know, I my attachment to this case is not peripheral. You know, it's absolutely fundamental. But that said, a lot of people seem to like how I go about it, which is only accidental, but it's how I go about it. You know, I do talk to people, I do win them over. We do have on the record conversations. We do move things forward. We do discover new things. And people like that approach. And they also like the long format. The fact that this isn't a one episode, then another different one, the next episode, things like that. Although they have merit and I love those things. But this is 50 hours on a case. And that's what it'll be. But I just know the sirens calls of other cases I can hear. And I probably will do another one, but I'll probably do it with someone else because it'd be too much for me to do. But I am quite excited about a few other ones as well.
Well, Mr. Davis, thank you so much for spending some time with us here today and discussing the case of Fred the Head and your fantastic podcast. I implore all of our listeners to check it out. Gobble it up. There are plenty of episodes to listen to. The runtime is consumable, and it's always interesting. So well done on the production and the investigation. It's very, very well done.
My absolute pleasure. And I'd like to see more of these things. I do like the long format, and there are not enough of them, I don't think.
Fully agree. And if you have any updates, if you want to come back on with something that you feel is significant to talk about before or when you release the episode, just to direct people there, let us know. And we'll make time for you.
Well, I'm very grateful. I really am grateful for your time today and listening to the story. Don't often do these things because I'm mainly got my nose to the grindstone in terms of solving this, but it's great to talk to other podcasters and great to talk to other people who are interested in true crime and are moving things forward. So, Tim, Lance, I'm grateful to you guys as well.